New details in the Jeffrey Epstein story, barriers to the ballot box, and commemorating victims of gun violence. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Testimony from Ghislaine Maxwell, a longtime employee of Jeffrey Epstein, illustrated his predatory behavior and showed who was in his inner circle. Plus, millions of ballots have already been cast in the November election, but whose votes won't make it to the ballot box? We'll speak with a reporter from Stateline, an initiative from the Pew Charitable Trust. And speaking of voting, we introduce you to a first-time voter out of Homestead.
Every 4 years, it's going to be the most important election of your life. And that's what it's going to be until you die.
Finally, we meet an artist who's painted hundreds of portraits of victims of gun violence. We'll talk with her about commemorating the lives of those lost. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Testimony from one of the key figures in the Jeffrey Epstein case has been made public, shedding a new light on who was involved in the sex trafficking ring that started in Palm Beach County. The 465-page transcript from Ghislaine Maxwell, a former employee and partner of Epstein, was made public on Thursday. The documents paint a picture of Epstein's predatory behavior and his business dealings with high-profile public figures. It could have serious legal implications. Kevin G. Hall is a senior investigative reporter for McClatchy in Washington, D.C. He scoured through the documents and joins us now to discuss the key findings. Kevin, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
It was a long fight for Ghislaine Maxwell's testimony to finally be released. What were the circumstances for them to finally be made public?
Well, the testimony itself happened back in 2016. The Miami Herald sued for these documents once the 2017 settlement happened. Again, it's between Ghislaine Maxwell, who was Epstein's, for lack of a better word, muse, and Virginia Roberts Dufry, one of Epstein's accusers, his principal accuser. That case was settled as a civil lawsuit in 2017. Miami Herald sued to have motions and transcripts, depositions released in July. We won that case in front of District Judge Preska, Loretta Preska. And in August, information started trickling out, but Maxwell tried real hard to block this large transcript. She appealed to the Second Circuit, which a couple Mondays ago said no thanks, and it was ordered released.
You said she was like his muse, but remind us of Maxwell and her connection to Jeffrey Epstein. What exactly was she to him? What did she do for him?
Yes, and it's a tough question to answer. You know, we've kind of started shying away from using the word his madam, because some of the victims feel like it makes them seem as if they're prostitutes, and they weren't. They were children who were brought in from masseuses and kind of coerced into sexual activity, or sometimes had it forced on them. She was a person who came into his life in the early 90s. There's a dispute exactly the circumstances, whether they met in London or in New York, but they were fairly inseparable after that point. They dated briefly in the transcript. She twice kind of punts on the question of describing their relationship or whether she was his girlfriend. She kind of lets on she wished it were that easy. He seems to have been hard to tie down to one person. But she was involved in his life from a business standpoint, not just a personal standpoint. She was in charge of hiring people for all his properties around the world, architects, housekeepers, every imaginable kind of hire you might do. Knew him intimately, but then in the transcript, mysteriously, had no idea how he made his money and offered almost no detail about him, which made it one of the reasons why people found the transcript so fascinating, that she had such selective memory.
And there's another person in this story, her father. So who was her father, and how did she become connected? Was it just through Jeffrey Epstein, connected to the Palm Beach elite?
Well, that's one of the many, many mysteries in the Epstein-Maxwell saga. Robert Maxwell, her father, was a very, very famous British newspaper baron, or media baron, When he died, he died mysteriously in the Mediterranean. The ruling was he fell off his yacht, the Lady Gisland, named after his daughter, died. There is some evidence that Epstein actually worked for her father sort of as a financial repo man, you know, helping him kind of collect past due debts. Or the other theory is that perhaps he was involved in helping Maxwell hide money. Mr. Maxwell, after his death, was discovered to have looted the pension fund of his companies and defrauded pensioners from his empire. One of the million-dollar questions, of course, is what happened to that money? Did Epstein have a hand in having it overseas? Did Epstein then manage it for himself and Maxwell? All questions that nobody has a firm answer to, but indications.
Yeah. What connections were made in the documents to former President Bill Clinton and current President Donald Trump?
Directly, their names, to Trump, not so much, although there are other ways they tie. To Clinton, Clinton appears in about 27 times in flight logs on Epstein's aircraft. He's referenced in, it's clear through the document, even though his name was redacted, that there was references to him, there's references to a Social Security, a Secret Service detail and things of that sort. There have been long-standing rumors that perhaps Maxwell and Clinton had a relationship of some sort, but like many things in this saga, it's rumor and hard to confirm. What is known is that Clinton did fly on the planes. I believe he's denied that he's ever on a Little St. James Island in the U.S. Virgin Islands, which was Epstein's main property, although some of the victims have testified to seeing them. No one has alleged that he was involved in sexual misconduct with minors in the way that others have been alleged, like Prince Andrew, for instance.
And that's one of the key figures that keeps popping up, too, was Prince Andrew. So what was his involvement in this?
Well, there are photos in London of Andrew in Maxwell's apartment with the chief accuser, Virginia Roberts Jeufre. Andrew's real kind of isolation from the royal family started after these photos came out, and he did a now infamous BBC interview where he said he had no idea where it came from. He really performed poorly in the interview and seemed to show almost no remorse either, and didn't really have an explanation for how he's got his arm around a young woman who he claims he's never met and doesn't know where the photo came from. But he was also photographed later, after Epstein had come out of jail. He still visited Epstein and was photographed coming out of his apartment, his mansion in New York, and then later referred to it as an error in judgment.
Yeah, and
a lot of people thought that was an understatement.
You know, and Miami Herald investigative reporter Julie K. Brown had tweeted not too long ago that the names of the four underage victims were not redacted from the court filings, while Bill Clinton, Prince Andrew, Alan Dershowitz's name all blacked out. Is there a concern here that the court is letting Maxwell's lawyers kind of run the show?
No, I think Julie was, her observation wasn't meant to call that in question as much as just to note the irony of it. We actually chose not to use the victims' names, even though they were redacted, because we weren't sure that was the intent, and we didn't feel like it was the proper thing to name them. And the men whose names were redacted, I mean, Dershowitz actually filed a motion to intervene to say, please release my name, I don't want to be redacted. Is he, for your listeners, Dershowitz, the celebrity lawyer, Roberts Jeufre, alleges that she was forced to have sex with him as well. He denies it and denies knowing her. And he and her have counter defamation suits, one against the other. So Dershowitz kind of falls in and out of this story because he's suing on a couple different levels.
Again, I'm talking with senior investigative reporter and McClatchy, Kevin G. Hall. Again, last week, 465 pages of testimony from Ghislaine Maxwell released to the public, the former employee of Jeffrey Epstein. You could read more of Kevin's reporting on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Kevin, where do those lawsuits stand for the victims of Jeffrey Epstein?
Well, there's several lawsuits. It's a multi-pronged answer. So in the case of this, which was the settlement of the released, the documents that come from this settlement, they're actually the key document is could come any day now. It's, you know, Maxwell, because she was so, she answered so few questions directly in this 400-plus page document, she was forced to give another deposition in July where she was forced to answer these questions by the court. And that is the one that everybody's waiting for, because this ties into also her federal prosecution. She was charged on sex trafficking crimes, and she was trying to block the deposition release because she claims it'll prejudice the case against her. In that federal criminal case, there are perjury charges against her based on her not answering truthfully in these depositions we're seeing. The other lawsuits that are out there, there's a victim's compensation fund now that's been operating since June, where his victims, if they want to avoid the glare of the public court system, can seek compensation through that mechanism, and that is up and running, and I have a sense that it's working fairly well.
Yeah.
Separately, there's another suit against the estate, and Maxwell is actually suing Epstein's estate, saying she needs to pay. They need to pay her bills, and then you've got his estate has been considered for RICO, racketeering purposes, a criminal organization. And the money they're recovering, they're trying to put into the compensation fund for the victims.
And what's next in the trial for Maxwell?
Well, the federal criminal trial in New York is now slated for July. She's been denied bail, so she's continuing to be held in a Manhattan jail cell for her own protection. I believe she's pretty isolated. I know they've complained about the isolation. It's quite a come down for someone who is used to the life of a British socialite. But barring anything unexpected, like a settlement of some sort or a plea, she's scheduled to go to trial in July.
And more to this story as it unfolds. We will keep bringing it to you. Again, speaking with McClatchy reporter Kevin G. Hall. You can read his reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Kevin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So over the past several months, WLRN has been following first-time Latino voters as part of the project Every 30 Seconds. Every 30 seconds, another Latino becomes an eligible voter in the U.S. Jacob Cuenca is a 19-year-old registered Republican from Homestead. When we first met him in March, Jacob was excited to vote, and he knew who he planned to vote for, President Trump. WLRN's Danny Rivero tells us the pandemic shook up everything in Jacob's life.
Jacob Cuenca is a man with time on his hands. He was supposed to be in his first semester of college on a scholarship. And what was supposed to be a fall at school in Colorado has turned into a fall with his family in Homestead. And he's been so bored, he's taken up arts and crafts.
I mean, like an ashtray. But I told my mom it was a box.
While he's not telling white lies to his mom about his secret, not-so-secret smoking habit, Jacob has been sleeping a lot and moping around.
I have a lot of discontent right now. I don't know, I don't have to do anymore. I feel like I've done everything. Like, I've watched like every single thing on Netflix or something, like, or like on HBO. Like, I don't know.
At the beginning of the year, Jacob was keeping up with all the news all the time. He registered to vote in March as a Republican and planned to support President Trump. And now?
It had to be Joe Biden. But like right now, like I don't really care about politics at all, honestly. Because like I kind of just like I already made up my mind on who I think I'm going to vote for, and I don't think it's going to change, honestly.
To hear Jacob say he doesn't care about politics at all, it's kind of jarring. When I first met him about a week before the pandemic hit Florida, he was 18. He loved his U.S. history class and was excited to be a part of the democratic process.
I think it's been great, great experience. And I really do hope my vote does make a change now. I think that's what anyone can like hope for, their vote does matter.
His mom's a Democrat and his dad's a Republican. And both sides have rubbed off on him in their ways. But he says Democrats have historically helped pull the country out of recessions.
So, like, I still consider myself a conservative. Just like right now, like the Republican going against the Democrat, I'd rather vote for the Democrat this time, But hopefully next time, maybe Mitt Romney or something, we'll run. I don't know.
Traditionally, Republican positions on things like taxes are what attracts Jacob to the party. He says that one day he hopes to be rich, and when he gets rich, he doesn't think he should pay more in taxes than anyone else. In October, Jacob got his vote-by-mail ballot in the mailbox. After all the time thinking and talking about voting for the first time in his life, the reality wasn't exactly what he imagined.
That was kind of anticlimactic, you know, just like filled in a piece of paper and I gave it to my mom and that was it.
He voted yes on raising the minimum wage in Florida. Yes on letting everyone vote in primary elections, regardless of party affiliation. And in a congressional race, he split his ticket to vote for Republican Carlos Jimenez. Voting for a Democrat here, a Republican there, Jacob is totally cool with this. He says it's about the person and the policy, not some kind of gang affiliation.
It's like West Coast against East Coast. It's like, yeah, I hate that whole like mentality.
Democracy is sloppy, incremental, and can feel underwhelming and disappointing. It's a lesson that Jacob is quickly learning in his first go-round.
My dad the other day was just like talking about politics, and he's like, look, like every 4 years, it's going to be the most important election of your life. And that's what it's going to be until you die. And he's like, does it ever really matter? Maybe. He's like, am I still going to vote? Yeah. But like, does it ever really change? Probably not. I was like, damn, like someone who's like lived that long and has this, like, that's what they have to say about like voting in our country. Like, it's kind of sucks.
The reality is that Jacob, like many other voters, doesn't clearly fit into one political party or narrative. He's resentful of the two-party system, but he doesn't really see how to break out of it.
I still believe we're the greatest nation, but like, could it be better? Yeah, but like, will it ever be better? Hopefully.
On election night, Jacob Cuenca will be watching the results of his first vote with his Democratic mom and his Republican dad. And all of them, for different reasons, will be keeping their fingers crossed. I'm Danny Rivero in Miami.
And we're going to be checking in with Jacob again after the election. You can hear earlier stories about his path to his first election on WLRN.org. This piece was produced with The World from PRI and the project Every 30 Seconds. Well, still to come, Jacob is one of many who have voted this election in Florida, but who won't be able to, though. The barriers to the ballot box in the Sunshine State coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Election Day is almost here. It's a little more than a week away, and millions of voters have already cast their ballots throughout the country. The coronavirus pandemic has shifted the normal elections process for many Americans this year, and it may be further complicating things. State Line, an initiative with the Pew Charitable Trust, has launched an investigation called Barriers to the Ballot Box. Reporter Matt Vallison-Gombros has been exploring these issues for State Line, and he joins us now. Matt, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me on.
What are some of the barriers, Matt, to voting across the U.S. that the Pew Research Center is following across the country right now?
Well, we started our project primarily looking at how, since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, that there has been a widespread amount of polling place closures across the country. And with more polling place closures, you run the risk of having longer lines, discouraging people from showing up at the polls. But, you know, barriers to the ballot box can you know, really apply to a lot of policies. It can be voter ID. It could be, strict witness signatures on vote by mail. But it can also be confusion and voter intimidation and disinformation. So it's the wide array of issues that we're talking about here. And even in progressive states that, you know, have fine-tuned their vote-by-mail systems, they still are at any bit of risk for disinformation and other things that might keep minority voters, young people, students, the poor from reaching the ballot box.
And you have all of that, and on top of it, a pandemic. And how is that added to this the challenges?
Well, voting rights experts and local election officials, you know, I speak a lot with county election officials in Florida, since they are kind of some of the best in the country and most in tuned at this. They have tell me that the pandemic really laid bare the lack of resiliency in American democracy. You know, there is no federal, one shop that is determining election policy and running elections across the country, it's 10,000. It's your municipalities, it's your counties, it's your cities. And a lot of them just did not have the funding or the policy in place to run an election properly during a pandemic. But, you know, again, there's a gradient here. Not every state is Washington State or Colorado that has been doing this for a while. And on the other end, it's states like Alabama and Mississippi that don't have a very sophisticated vote-by-mail system. Florida, on the other hand, some counties have been voting by mail and encouraging this for many years now. And in my conversations from Pasco County to Seminole County and throughout the entire state there, you know, they've been testing new tools for voters, tracking your ballot online like an Amazon package, you know, trying to create a more safe in-person voting environment. There are these measures that are being put into place, but obviously the challenges are substantial.
Yeah, let's touch on some of the things you mentioned, though, a moment ago. Like, for example, poll closures, reduction of poll workers. Do we have a sense of how that's going to be impacting, you know, voting this here in Florida this election?
We've already seen kind of hints of that in Broward and Miami-Dade. First day of election, early voting this year. Obviously, there are probably several different reasons why this happened. But, you know, with poll enclosures and reduced numbers, that's when you get kind of that bottleneck. You get those lines that you see. We saw, you know, hours-long lines in Miami-Dade and in Broward on that first election. But we also saw, you know, 355,000 Floridians fled to the polls. And so the effects of poll closure really is lines. And it's those images that you see on social media that say, like, oh, do I really want to be going out there right now and having to spend, you know, an inordinate amount of time at the poll? And I think the lesson to be learned when you see the lines and when you kind of have those gut feelings, those fears that your vote might be at risk, is to, if you're going to vote, vote now, vote early. And if you're going to send it by mail, send it now. Don't wait for these deadlines that are close to election day, because, you know, as your listeners are well aware, the post office has had its own issues.
Yeah.
And there's obviously some confusion over ballot boxes and the sort.
And you talked about, again, you know, looking at those wait times. And we do have a link, by the way, on our social media, WLR and Sundial, where you can track, you know, where those polls are, by the way, and what the wait time might be in some of those places. Talking about the post office, concerns for months about the U.S. post office ability to handle this surge of mail-in ballots are going to break records. Does that still remain top of mind as we're getting closer to Election Day?
Absolutely, it should. I mean, these issues have not gone away. And even if it hasn't been on the front pages for a while, and the Postmaster General says that some of the issues have been resolved. And obviously, we want to take these public officials at their word in some regard, but also it still requires a sense of caution here. You know, I'm not saying that your ballot is going to get lost in the mail, and I do not want to fearmonger like a lot of folks have done. But I think the lesson is just to be cautious, to send your ballot in soon. And in Florida, you're one of those states that allow you, like I mentioned earlier, to track your ballot online. So send it in, follow it, and make sure that your ballot has been accepted, because Florida has been one of the leaders in the country in rejecting ballots for having missing or mismatched signatures. And so you want to make sure that your ballot is counted. And if you do have to, what is called, cure your ballot to fix it, that you can do it. You can check your mail, check your email to see if the county's telling you, hey, fix your ballot. We really want your vote to count here.
Again, I'm talking with reporter Matt Valisagambros with the State Line and the Pew Charitable Trust. The new series, Barriers to the Ballot Box, is an investigation on how poll closures, the coronavirus, and legal challenges are creating barriers to voting. And we've included more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. There's a large population of people returning to eligibility for voting in Florida, but they can't yet because they have to meet a requirement of paying back fines and fees. Do we have a sense of how many people that's going to impact in Florida this year?
You know, that's been really tough, even for me to track, and I cover these issues. And if it's difficult for me and other reporters to try to get the latest, you know, I can't imagine what it's like to be a voter that's kind of impacted on this. We're hearing several things from your from the state, including from the Secretary of State's office. I believe that 67,000 people, former felons, have been able to register to vote. And but we heard last week that the state is going to start removing some of those voters from the rolls because of, you know, some of the confusion over paid fines. Now, the Secretary of State says that is only going to impact around 100 people between now and the election, but that's still up in the air. And this does get back to the question of confusion. There are so many court cases kind of up in the air right now regarding a whole host of things, whether it's, you know, Dropbox hours or you, whether you need a paper backup for voter registration rolls, or even around this issue of ex-felons voting. And, you know, we don't, so again, it might be tens of thousands of new registered voters. But again, there's some confusion there, and it's up to those registered voters to, those new registered voters to check their status online to make sure that they actually have that right to vote.
And then you also touched on the issue of voter disinformation here in Florida. How has that happened? What have you seen?
Yeah, it's actually been a little disconcerting, and not a little, it's been a lot disconcerting in Florida. There's been two glaring examples of this. One is many voters, many black voters in this in your state, got emails purportedly from the far-right extremist group Proud Boys. Now, what we found out last week from U.S. intelligence officials was that those emails were actually from Iran, and that that is part of a broader disinformation campaign from Iran, and there are other disinformation campaigns from Russia as well. So that's key. The second thing is on South Florida Spanish language radio programs, there has been a whole host of disinformation out there telling voters that if you don't vote by, if you vote by mail, that your ballot's going to be thrown away, that your that your personal information is going to be given to creditors, that there's rampant fraud. And all of that is false. There is no evidence whatsoever that there is widespread fraud. But these programs, these this disinformation is being circulated on Spanish language radio. And so it's just very key when we see bits of disinformation here, we see something that says like, oh, no, your election day is different than other people's election day, or anything about fraud. I think it's just really important to find a trusted news source, which should be your county or your city election official. I would also really urge patience here, because it's going to take a really long time with all of these new mail-in ballots to count them. And we want to make sure that we're not expecting necessarily the results of all these races on election night. It might happen a couple days later, or it might happen in a week, but you need to have that kind of patience.
Okay. And you know, we keep mentioning that as well, that it may not be resolved the night of. You know, the other, we're talking about disinformation. There was a story out of Palm Beach County where voters were given a fake Democratic voter guide, which incorrectly listed Laura Loomer as the Democratic congressional candidate in the district. And we're going to include a story from our news partner, the Sun Sentinel, online so people could see that. But just, again, to point that out, keep an eye out for that. You know what, Matt? When do voters need to have their ballots postmarked in order to make sure that they are counted?
In Florida, ballots must arrive by 7 p.m. on election day. So that's not, so you can't wait to send your mail-in ballot on election day. Most election officials would caution you and say, send it the Thursday before election day as your latest, because you give the post office several days to get that in. Florida does have the ability, Floridians do have the ability to, like what I mentioned earlier, cure, you know, fix your signatures, cure your ballots 2 days past the election. But again, that is a last minute deal. Please do not wait to do that. And really rely on the, you know, the social media presence of your election official. Go to the websites. It's very easy to find. And if you don't want to try to, you know, go around your county election website, vote.org. It's a very comprehensive, intuitive website to check out.
You know, and the other thing is just a reminder, look at your calendar. We're almost there. So it's you remind yourself that we're getting very close. So if you haven't, please get to that point now. Matt, what stories are you going to be following this week, especially in Florida, when we talk about the vote?
Well, I want to keep an eye on lines. It seemed to be kind of an issue in the first few days, and it's kind of petered out. But really, what's been shocking to me is the level of enthusiasm I'm seeing across the country. Just this morning, there's new numbers out that say 61 million Americans have already voted thus far. That's 40.2 million by mail. And Florida represents a tenth of that number. So Floridians are showing up in droves right now trying to vote, and I think that should be lauded. So I'm going to continue to follow this impressive turnout. I hope it continues. But, you know, I would just continue to add caution about disinformation and misinformation. Just, you know, make sure we just don't blow those deadlines, because it sneaks up on you, and you want to just make sure your vote's counted.
Again, we've been talking with reporter Matt Vasiligombros with Stateline and the Pew Charitable Trust. Check out the new series, Barriers to the Ballot Box, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Matt, really appreciate the insight. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, using art to commemorate the lives of gun violence victims, we're going to introduce you to Chaya Regans. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. When they leave us, we remember our loved ones through images, maybe pictures, and we tell their stories, sharing their names proudly. In the same way, artist Chaya Regans has dedicated her work to honoring those who've been affected by gun violence. Her artist name is Vanta Black, and she created the Memorial Portrait Project, which includes over 200 portraits of gun violence victims. And she's now working on a new mural titled Say Their Names, also dedicated to the victims and their families. She's being recognized by Oolite Arts as the 2020 Ellie's Social Justice winner for her commitment to social awareness and change. And Chaya joins us now. It's such a pleasure. Thanks so much, Chaya.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You started these portraits after the killing of six-year-old King Carter. Why were you taken by that case, by that story?
I was taken by that story because King Carter was, at the time, the same age as my son, Cypher. And every time I saw King on the news, I saw my son. And it very well could have been my child whose life was taken in broad daylight. So I felt a really deep connection to his family. And I thought that I had to do something in response to the tragedy that happened to him and his family.
Tell me a little bit about the portrait you made of King Carter.
So I went through a bunch of photographs of King, and there was one photograph that really struck me, and he was smiling. He had a really beautiful smile and very bright eyes, and that image spoke to me. So that's the image that I chose to do his portrait with. And I struggled through that piece, and it's full of a lot of emotion. And every time I see that work, I'm taken back to that moment, and I'm glad that it's in that work. And I try to always capture how I'm feeling in the portraits that I do of victims.
As you said, you're a mom, and I wonder, do you have conversations with your kids about gun violence?
Not very frequently, but, you know, I work from home a lot of times on the pieces that I create, and my kids do watch me. And there was one moment where my daughter was watching me create a portrait of a seven-year-old named Amir Castro, and she asked me about him, and she asked me if she could play with him. So then we had to have that conversation about why she couldn't play with him. And she did grasp the concept of him being gone, but I really try to shield them from, you know, what's happening now. And if they ask me a question, I answer it.
You have over 200 plus portraits of different victims affected by gun violence. Why did you choose to remember these people through portraits?
I think that portraiture is a way to really capture someone's essence. And as an artist, I communicate with people who I depict. And part of my process is to ask for guidance and to try to get as close to this person's life as I can. I try to know a lot about this person and that informs this process. And I think there's something really beautiful about capturing someone's face, you know?
And then you look at the other project that you're working on. You've got a mural that's going to debut this month at the Bakehouse in Wynwood. It's called Say Their Names. Why did you turn to names this time as opposed to the portraits?
I am very careful about where I place these portraits because they are very close to my heart and they depict actual people. And this mural, I wanted to focus on text because it's important to connect to the names of people also and not diminish them to numbers. And I wanted this space to be accessible. I wanted it to be a place of remembrance, reflection, and I wanted people to see the scope and the scale of how gun violence affects us.
And how many names are on that mural?
Currently, there are about 450 names on the wall.
Currently, that means this is a piece you think you're going to be sadly adding to.
Yes, unfortunately, I'll probably add about another 250 names.
On that mural, you have three languages. Why was that important?
It was important for me to include these three languages because English, Spanish, and Creole are the main languages spoken in South Florida, and I wanted to show people that there isn't just one community affected by this type of tragedy. It affects all communities. And I wanted people to connect through language to this work.
Again, I'm talking with Chaya Regans. She is the 2020 Oolite Arts LA Social Justice winner. Her artist name again is Vanta Black, and she is being recognized for her commitment to working for equality in her daily life and artistic practice. Her work is focused on bringing the names and faces of gun violence victims to the spotlight. And you can find a video of her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I wanted to come back to the story of six-year-old King Carter. You actually had King's family visit you recently at this mural, right?
Yes. Yes, I did.
What happened?
It was a surprise. I actually received a message from King's mother, Monica. She messaged me on my social media, and I was out there at the wall. And she asked me for the address, and I gave it to her. And then she was there within a few minutes, and her husband came. His name is Santonio. And they showed up, and I hadn't seen them in months. And they came, and they saw King's name in person for the first time, and they thanked me. And then we talked about other victims that they had known and heard about and families of these victims they had interacted with. And they really thanked me for the work that I do. And I was just really, really grateful, really grateful.
Do you keep in touch with the families whose lives you touch through their art, through the art?
I do. I am very close to a lot of families because it's important for me to maintain our relationships because they're important. And I like to keep them, you know, up to date on, you know, what I do and what I say. And when you connect to people through tragedy, that's a type of connection that doesn't go away. And a lot of these families are friends of mine.
You yourself, and I'm sad to hear this, as you've experienced the loss of a loved one through gun violence. You made a portrait of James Reed III, one of the people close to you, who you lost. How does that portrait represent who he was?
Because I knew him personally, I knew, you know, which image I wanted to use of him, and it was actually the image that was on his obituary. And he had taken photographs in high school, and this was one of the images that they used on his obituary. And we actually met in high school. And it was important for me to use that one because I knew that so many people that loved him were familiar with that image. And you know, going to a funeral as a teenager is surreal. You know, a lot of it is a blur. You know, he died in 1996, and it was the first funeral that I had ever been to. And it was mostly, you know, high school students there. And that helps me put into perspective when I talk to families and survivors. Now they've experienced that loss, you know, 5, 6, 7 times over. So I can't imagine that type of grief, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, but like, well, James, you knew him. So you, I think you were close enough and you had a sense of the essence of James you wanted to get in that portrait. But coming back to like when you're doing any portrait of anybody, you know, is there something specific you're looking for that you want to capture from that person?
Yes. You know, I spent a lot of time looking for photos, looking through photos, if a family didn't give me a specific one to use. And usually a photo will speak to me. And I through you know, this process of creating their portrait, I asked for permission and guidance, and I tried to know as much about this person as I can, you know, because I didn't know them in life, but I want to do them this honor in death and try to connect with them in that way.
Something interesting about you, you serve on the Miami-Dade Community Relations Board where you work on police issues. And I'm wondering, what do you bring to these conversations, given your own experience and again, the proximity to these families that have been affected by gun violence? What kind of conversations do you try to bring up?
I try to speak from the perspective of a member of the community. And I say things that have been repeatedly said to me by families affected by this tragedy. And I try to be that voice in these conversations with law enforcement and other members of the community. And, you know, it's a different perspective that is needed in these dialogues because, you know, there are so many families that cannot speak for themselves because they don't trust these, you know, they don't trust these different entities. So I'm there to be their voice.
Yeah, I'm wondering, what have family members told you about, you know, that law enforcement or politicians may not understand about the issue of gun violence?
Well, one of the common things I hear is that when they suffer this tragedy, law enforcement looks at them like they committed the crime. And they are not given the resources that they need to endure this type of tragedy. And they are often, their lives are picked apart, even by the media. You know, their backgrounds are brought up, their child's background is brought up, when it's not important, you know. The focus should be on what caused their loss. And also, you know, issues of support, you know, mental services, grief counseling, and how that should be high importance in, you know, how funding is distributed throughout our county and throughout our state. You know, those that suffer this tragedy, they're often pushed to the wayside and ignored. And I try to always bring that to the table in these conversations.
I wonder, have any politicians or people in law enforcement come to you after they saw the portraits or have seen any of your work? I just wonder if they have, if they've looked at it and have anything to say.
Yeah. They reach out to me in a number of ways. Actually, a couple weeks ago, a member of Miami Police Department reached out to me, and we had a dialogue about why I chose to focus on these victims and not the police. And then we had a conversation in person. He visited the wall, and then we talked about, you know, how these things happen and the role that law enforcement plays in these shootings. And it was a really good conversation, and I respected his input. And he has been an officer for almost 30 years, and we had a very open and candid dialogue about this work.
And I'm wondering if anybody's come up to you and it said anything that surprised you, but you know, that and how your work has affected them and their look at life, their outlook at life, and but especially on the issue of gun violence.
You know, a lot of people come past Bakehouse because, you know, it's in an open area, and there's a lot of foot traffic through there. And there have been several instances where someone has walked by and not realized that someone that they knew was on the wall. And, you know, I like to watch people interact with this piece because, you know, it's a honest response, you know. And once they realize that someone that they know is here, we have a dialogue about how that affects them and why I'm doing this work.
How do you as an artist think that, you know, art can help us to heal, but also maybe help us as a society get better?
You know, I like to quote Nina Simone frequently. She said that an artist has a duty to reflect the times, and that is my mantra. And artists can give voice to the voiceless. We can get people to talk about things that they aren't necessarily comfortable talking about. And just an image can affect a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. Even if I don't have the dialogue, someone who sees this work will have a dialogue with someone else that they encounter. And then it spreads from there. And I think that that's an important role for an artist to take up. And I think that we all should do that.
As I mentioned before, you won the Oolite Arts New Social Justice Award. Where were you? How'd you find out?
Well, I found out via Zoom, because, you know, this is the age of COVID. So I found out via Zoom, and I was already emotional because I found out the same day that the information came out that Breonna Taylor's killers were not going to be prosecuted. So I was really emotional. And I had this meeting, and my first response was to break down and cry, you know, because I was just flooded with emotion, and I wasn't expecting this. And once I got myself together, you know, I was like, this is confirmation that this is what I'm supposed to do, and I have to continue to do it, because it is difficult work, but it is necessary work.
And, you know, you kind of touched on this, but, you know, just I wanted your take on it. You know, what is it you hope people will get when they walk by, they see the portraits, or they see the names on the wall in the mural? What do you want them to think about or ask?
I want people to think about these names, and that there are so many on this wall, and that this is just a small glimpse of the toll that gun violence takes on communities across the country. And I also want them to feel like maybe there's something I can do about this. What can I do? This is an artist, and this is what this artist decided to do, but what can I do? What can I do about, even if it's not this issue, any other issue that they care about? You know, we all can do something about whatever we care about.
Chaya Regans, again, is a teaching artist at the PAM and the 2020 Oolite Arts Ellie's Social Justice winner. Chaya, thank you so much. By the way, congratulations, because I didn't say that to you before. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And again, you can find a video of her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Monday, October 26. Sundial Senior Producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. Our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And don't forget that our theme music for the show is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. If you missed any of the program, don't sweat it. You can always catch the show tonight at 8 o'clock, or you can always just find the podcast, because it is a podcast. Just search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, Broward County Commissioners have unanimously approved the creation of a Police and Criminal Justice Review Board. What powers will the board have in holding law enforcement accountable for their actions and reforming the county's criminal justice system? We're going to hear from the new Florida majority who holds a seat on the board. Plus, the University of Miami has been accused of using facial recognition technology to target graduate students wearing masks during a protest. We're going to learn about the debate on college campuses about using this technology and how students are responding. And as always, we want to hear from you. Respond to us about what you hear on the program. Find us in many different ways. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think. And of course, if there's a story or issue that we should be covering, let us know about it. Again, at WLRN Sundial, or email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thanks so much. Please stay safe, be good to each other, and we'll talk to you again live tomorrow.